I will be a late riser when I go into retirement mode too. I like to sleep
Yeah, okay.
in. Okay, so we're recording.
Okay.
Everything's good. Anything you say can and will be held against you. Beautiful. Thank you all for joining us. We are recording today on a cold morning in February, which really drives home how grateful I am to have the opportunity to facilitate a virtual learning opportunity with one of my favorite teachers of all time. For anyone who doesn't know, I'm Kendall G. I'm the agronomy lead with Crop Intelligence, and I'm here in Weyburn, Saskatchewan today. So I asked Mike Dolinsky if he would be interested in delivering a webinar for our Crop Intelligence customers. We started the Crop Intelligence software utilizing rain and soil moisture. In 2020, we brought in additional environmental sensor data to our platform. Each year, there are factors other than water that impact yield potential on our fields. Frost, heat, wind, weeds, insects, disease, and so many more. I thought it would be interesting to take a bit of a deep dive into some plant physiology and the stress responses of our commonly grown crops. Mike Dolinsky grew up on a small farm in southern Manitoba and moved to Alberta as provincial entomologist in 1972 after finishing a master's in entomology at the University of Manitoba. He worked for over 32 years with Alberta Agriculture, where he held roles as an entomologist, vertebrate specialist, apiculturist, and finally as organic agriculture specialist. He retired in 2004, but has not slowed down since. I first met Mike in his role as a senior agri coach with AgriTrend. He supported one of my very first customer meetings that I hosted in Regina. Over the past 10 years, Mike has focused on plant physiology, growth, and nutrition. He leverages his microscopic photographs to support his learning and his presentations to train agronomists and farmers. Mike is an avid fisherman, golfer, and grandfather, and most importantly, a passionate teacher. I'm excited to introduce you all to him today. Take it away, Mike.
Well, let me go back here. Thanks a lot, Kendall. Has indeed been a pleasure working for you from that very first meeting in Regina over the years, and to see you grow into a specialist in crop intelligence and water. And this presentation is in a partnership with Crop Intelligence. Taurus, who I work for as Director of Science and Innovation now, has been involved in the water process at Ag in Motion from the perspective of providing plants nutrients to help them grow through stresses. And it seemed like a good time to talk about stress management in plants. I never took a plant science course. I never took a physiology course, but I've had the luxury of in retirement and working for AgriTrend and now with Taurus to have time to read a lot of stuff and with my trusty microscope beside me to take a lot of photographs that I love to show to farmers about how plants grow. So this series of two is going to be held, and I'm going to initially talk about how plants grow and the stuff that nobody tells you. The second part of it will be about how plants deal with stress. Now, the strategy here is that if farmers or retailers don't know how plants truly grow and understand the physiology of the plant, which is what in fact causes the problem for stress, to tell the honest truth, then how would you know that the darn thing was stressed and what to do about it? So this first part is all about setting you up, understanding the basics of a plant and how it grows and deals with all the stresses in life in this earth. So here we're going to go. We're going to start. And this presentation is quite lengthy. It is in fair detail. It'll get easier over time as I move from a lot of diagrams and so on and theories to actual shots that I've taken with the microscope. So every picture you see here, that's a real picture, is something I shot, was behind the camera or the microscope when that was done. You also notice I use a lot of diagrams from scientific papers and journals and so on, and I read nothing but the current literature. And it's been my observation over time that we don't have to reinvent a whole lot for agriculture at the moment because we're not even using what we already know. So one of my plans over, the rest of my life is to, in fact, try and take this education to farmers and to kids and everywhere. So here, how's the plant grow? And then we'll talk tomorrow in the next session. I keep sometimes saying tomorrow because we are going to initially do this in 2 days. What causes stress? How do the plants deal with the stress? And your role as a farmer, and this is targeted mostly at farmers. Now, many coaches or agronomists are going to be listening, and many of them have had university degrees and took this stuff somewhere along the line, unless they were in economics or something, or maybe even in soils. They didn't take anything in biology. So they will twig onto it quickly. For farmers and older gents who haven't taken any of this biology or took it 50 years ago when I did when I was at university, things have changed a lot. So the one point I want to make is it is intense. There's no test at the end of the day. You can read it at your leisure. And, you're not going to see all this stuff because this is at the cellular level. So let's get going. So each plant living in this picture is living in a different environment. Its roots are in the ground. The soil nutrient quality varies. The structure varies. The vertical distribution of nutrients and water varies. What's on top of the hill is a different environment than the bottom of the hill. And that they still have two goals. The main goal is to develop a state of homeostasis where everything in the cell is in equilibrium. And it's no different than us as human beings. And I like to use people as a parallel to a plant where, we use the same enzymes. We use the same proteins. We use the same amino acids to make those proteins. And in fact, we eat plants or animals that eat those plants in order to get all our nutrients. And we need the same nutrients. So we're genetically not that different. So we need to get balance. And the plant, just like human cells, are trying to get balanced. Not too much, not too little, just right. And mineral nutrients and all the environmental factors that are responsible for that are monitored by the plant, just like they are in a human being, in what is typically talked as their plasma membrane. That's their relationship with the world to some degree, just like our skin is, and the cells in it and the plasma membrane read and sense the air temperature, the cold, the humidity, and so on. The plant is always monitoring everything, both in the rooting zone and the shoot zone, and keeps things in a very narrow balance. And the key thing from a stress point of view is its homeostasis of what are called reactive oxygen species. And that term for you that are sort of foodies and health fanatics will recognize reactive oxygen species as similar to free radicals, where oxygen molecules have been damaged. So homeostasis relative to stress, oxidative stress, is a balance between the production of reactive oxygen species, damaged oxygen molecules, and the scavenging of them. And they have mechanisms for that we'll cover in the next session. The other part or focus of all plants is to produce a good quality progeny. That's the objective. We grow crops here on the prairies that are monocarpic crops. In other words, they have one season to grow, except for the perennials, and that time frame is short, and the plant is programmed to germinate and it's programmed to die. It's called plant cell death during senescence, and the plant is going to die. That life cycle is 100 days, 120 days, sometimes shorter, depending on the season. Our life cycle's, 70, 80, 90, 100 years. So it's the same kind of principle. Now, within those parameters, we have nutrients. And I want to just talk about progeny here and the progeny and what nutrients are really important in progeny. Let's take a look at a couple of things I want to point out here. Let's take a look at boron. These are two wheat samples. These are two barley samples. And these are two pea samples. And there's some common things without even talking about the effect of nutrients. Look at wheat, 2 parts per million. Two here, 10. You see this all the time. Canola takes up a lot, or peas take up a lot more boron than other plants. And so do canola. In fact, the rule of thumb is, here's your first point, dicotyledonous plants uptake more boron than monocotyledonous plants. And by the way, for people who are real keeners, dicotyledonous plants, that term doesn't exist anymore. They are called eudicots. But for farmers, I'm going to still use that term, dicotyledonous plants, like canola, like peas, like alfalfa, compared to grasses. Copper. If you look across copper, not much difference, and there's a good reason. All plants use a lot of copper, most of it used in photosynthesis. Manganese, you look at wheat, big differences in these two. Not much difference here. Peas, a little bit more there. Phosphorus, big difference. Big difference, fair difference there. Potassium, not so much, not so much, a little bit. Zinc, look at the huge difference here. Not so much there and there. Now, what were those samples? These were wheat samples with germination of 98% and vigor 85, compared to good germination, can't do much about germination, but vigor of 75. And we'll just look at wheat. Look at the difference in zinc. The manganese was different. I've got it covered. The phosphorus difference is huge. That's about her. Phosphorus, potassium difference, not so much. Sulfur difference, not so much. When we go to barley, we can take a look, see it's similar things. Phosphorus difference, where we got bigger 81%, better phosphorus. Sulfur, not much difference. A little bit better zinc, but not so much. If we go over here to boron, I mentioned a big difference there, not so much in copper. Phosphorus difference, again, a big difference in phosphorus. Potassium, not much difference in zinc. The key point there is that every plant takes up a different set of nutrients and have different reasons for that depending on what they do with it. And I'll get back to seed nutrient vigor later. So remember that when you're planting your crop, you don't use the same fertility package for every crop in the same field, and that has been a common practice. So it's no wonder we have the plant being stressed and not able to reach its potential. It hasn't been fed properly. It's just like us, you don't give me spaghetti and meat sauce every day for year after year after year because sometimes I don't need it. So how does the plant do all that? Well, the plant is a very simple organism. It lives, it can't move. So it's evolved over a long time. And it goes like this. It takes up water and nutrients up the stem by transpiration. It takes it to the leaf. It runs it through photosynthesis. We get some sugar out of it. We get CO2 going in and we get water loss. And that water then is lost to the atmosphere, goes back into the xylem, and it circulates around, and its energy is driven by the sun. The only thing that plants need are CO2, oxygen, sunlight, water, and nutrients. Well, Mr. Farmer, can you do much about CO2? Not much. Can you do much about oxygen? Not much. Sunshine? Not much. Water? Yes, you can. Nutrients? For sure. Water's tougher. Your major tool to deal with the health of your plants and stress management and growth is nutrients. The 4R. How many of you are doing that? And I want to point out one thing here to get you thinking differently about your plants when you're in the field the next time. Look at it this way. The plant is controlled by what's called the apical meristem up here in the new shoot and down here at the root tip. There's one point that's important to remember. A root cannot feed itself. It has no capability to photosynthesize, so the shoot, the leaves, have to produce sugars and pump them to the roots to get them to grow, so they can then respire and can grow cells. So the root is called the sink. The leaf is called the source. This apical meristem is also the sink, because until the leaves are formed, it has to have nutrients from the old leaves. That sink-source relationship, controlled by auxins up here in the apical meristem and largely cytokinins and abscisic acid down here in the apical root meristem, are signaling each other, because this can't grow without the root and the root can't grow without the shoot. When the root is stressed and can't get nutrients, this can't grow, so the plant is forced to move those sugars and energy into the root to try and secure more of something, water and nutrients. That balance determines how much is here your seed package at the end of the year. So what does that look like? And this is where the pictures come in with my trusty microscope right here. These are peas, and I'll flop between peas and canola and wheat and you name it. So this is what you see when you look inside a clamshell on a pea, and then you can see this moves up here. Inside of there is the apical meristem. So here you got new tissue being developed, new organs being developed in the vegetative state, and down in here you've got the stem cells or the meristems being created that will form the next set and the next set and the next set until it goes reproductive. It'll switch hormonally, and before long you got flowers. Here's a soybean apical meristem right here that is controlling growth, and you can see the vascular system is quite well developed to move nutrients and hormones back and forth. And here's the apical meristem at the root tip. Now, the apical meristem is about here in something called a quiescent zone where stem cells are developed, and then they're expanded. And the plant is securing, and the tip, I'll spend more time on the root later, but the tip is not protected. And here's exudation of organic acids and so on and sugars to support rhizobial activity or microbial activity in the rhizosphere. And the root hair is developed, and I'll spend more time on that in a while. And that is all controlled by water. The water moving up pulls the nutrients, hits the leaves, the stomata open, and the water is in the vapor form, and the water leaves here and CO2 goes in. And the rest of it is cycled back through the veins and so on, back into the xylem and phloem. And I'll talk about that as well. And that whole process pulls a lot of water until you get here, heading and flowering. So during this period, we're developing the vegetative stage, which is leaves and all the reproductive material. And I want to repeat that. This vegetative stage is not about leaves and stems alone. All the reproductive tissue is being grown here. This is the sink until the plant pollinates. When the plant pollinates the embryo, suddenly the sink becomes the embryo and the seed, not the vegetative part. So you want to have this plant loaded with nutrients and water as much as you can before you hit pollination. After pollination, that sink will pull nutrients away from the root and everything else and focus it on the seed, because now that's subjective. As that goes on, then you get the seed drying down, and eventually we get a curve in the water. And the same is true here to reproductive period, which usually here comes somewhere, you know, depending on wheat, in early July, mid-July, depending on seeding, and you name it, with canola it's earlier. And the one thing also is when you get wheat, you know, it takes about 4 days to pollinate ahead, and then it carries on onto the tiller. With canola, it takes 30 days. With peas, it takes a long time. And that's important in terms of how you look at it. And I'll show you how those reproductive parts develop at the end. But I got to set you up in terms of understanding the principles of how this plant grows. So that's the overall principle. We need water, we need nutrients, we need to pull it, we need to develop it to reproductive stage. When that happens, we get a shift and the source sink changes. So let's take a look at the cells. Because without understanding the cells, yeah, we're kind of lost. So there's two kinds of cells in plants. There's what are called tip growth cells, and there's only two of them in the plant. And just think about it a minute. Try and tell me what it is, because I can't see you. And then there are what are called diffuse growth cells, or maybe, you know, we would call them things that make you grow taller. So the two cells that are grown by root tip, which is, and sometimes I use terms that maybe people don't understand, so I try to explain them. In a root tip growth, of which is the root hair and the pollen tube, it's a single cell. A root hair is a single cell. That way you can kill it. And it only lives 5-6 days, and then you produce new ones because they're easy to grow, fast to grow, and you can change the length of them if you grow them on a regular basis. The pollen tube is important for carrying the genetic material, and I'll show you exactly how that happens. But they're really key. And they grow by cytoplasmic streaming, so it moves nutrients from the back of it to the forward, and it extracts nutrients from the style as it's growing through to pollinate the ovary. ovule. The rest of the cells grow this lengthwise because we need to have the plant grow up way up upwards, and we need to have the roots grow laterally, or we have to have the roots grow down, whichever way. And that is done by hydraulic pressure. So when a cell is born, it's extremely tiny in that apical meristem or root meristem. So it's got to be expanded and stretched. And that's what drives the root to the ground is hydraulic pressure. And that's what drives the stem upward is hydraulic pressure on those cells that are created. Now think of it this way. If I'm a plant developing cells and I haven't got the nutrients and water to make more cells, I'm not going to grow. If I cannot make those cells and I haven't got the nitrogen for the proteins there, the phosphorus there for the DNA production and the plasma cell membranes around them, I'm stalled until I get more of those nutrients because I can't make a full plant out of parts. I need to make them out of cells that go in sequence as they grow, and I got to expand them to make them grow. And what do they look like? Well, you know, this is a shot of a coleoptile, and you can see the cells in here longitudinally. Here's a stem cell. You can see that they're long, so they're going to grow up, and they're expanding and forcing this up, and they're layered on each other. Now we got to take a look at the cell itself. Now here's some shots of cell wall, and I try to give you the best I can. And one thing that's important is all these little dots are calcium. The cell wall is made up of a lot of calcium, and the plant controls calcium level. Here's the vacuole, and the vacuole is this big part here in this cell, and it's where the plant stores things. It's not using right here for day-to-day kind of activities and housekeeping and producing some sugar and getting rid of some reactive oxygen species and defending off against diseases. So it restricts that because it's a secondary messenger in the plant. So calcium is there, and it ties up boron in this thing called pectin. And everybody hears about how calcium and boron ratios are important because the pectin is composed of a large chunk of the boron. About 90% of the boron is tied up in the cell wall in the pectin phase. And the more pectin in the plant, generally, the more boron that is needed. And that's why dicots or eutacots need more boron than do monocots, because there's more pectin in there to form those cell walls. And then here are the rebars that are in there. So the cell wall confines, is solid, because you want a plant to grow upright. So you better have it solid. It'll move, but you better have it solid. It'll flop down. The cell wall also restricts the size of the cell. So the plant knows when it's full size by the pressure that is put on that cell wall. And you can see here a whole bunch of things that I need to point out. There's the vacuole, which can push everything out and become about 80% of the cell. These are chloroplasts where photosynthesis takes place right here, these little green things. And these are stacks of what are called thylakoids, which are used for photosynthesis. And I'm talking about stuff now that is going to be coming up in the next session, because this is where a reactive oxygen or damage is going to occur in stress. And then these are called mitochondria here. And then these little dots here are called ribosomes. And this is the nucleus where the DNA is stored and all the genetic material is stored. And I'll talk to you about how things work in terms of plants responding to these stresses we're talking about going forward. I should point out, just because, I never took a plant science course. And so, of course, I didn't know anything about plants until about, 8-10 years ago when I started really getting interested. And I didn't realize that there's three genomes in plants. There's the nuclear genome. There's a genome that were just for chloroplast that is totally independent. And then there's a genome for mitochondria, because plants in the beginning never had chloroplast, and they never had mitochondria. So they had to steal them from other organisms and incorporate them and then use the nucleus to basically control them. There's only about 300 genes and combined in the mitochondria and the plastid groups. And chloroplast is just one of the plastids. The plastids, I should say, is a total group. And the other one that'll be important later is ameloplast. So we're getting a plant physiology course that will take you years to get, but we're going to struggle through this because you're never going to see any of this stuff, to tell you the honest truth. So you don't even know if I'm telling you the honest truth. But that's the cell. So within that self, we got all of these things like the mitochondria here, the vacuole, the nucleus, and we have these ribosomes producing all kinds of new proteins carrying them on. We've got enzymes, we've got iron, manganese, zinc, phosphorus, copper of all kinds in the chloroplast and iron. All of these nutrients in this liquid mess, just like in a human cell, have roles to play in all these what are called organelles. All these things are organelles. And you can see the phosphorus here in the DNA and the calcium that's involved in the DNA. And you can see that the zinc finger proteins are involved. So every cell is trying to balance all of this out to be homeostatic or in balance. And when you don't give it the nutrients in balance, it will try and jiggle it around to control that. And it does it this way. I should go back two, I think. I forgot to point this out. To see this blue line here? That's what's called the plasma membrane right here. You can see it. And there's a portal between cells called the, the plasmodesmata, which connects it. The next slide will show you. But that blue plasma membrane is lipid fats in here and phosphorus molecules that coat it here. And in that membrane, which is impermeable to most things, it puts in proteins. And these proteins are sensor proteins that are sensing the environment around them. And they're transporter proteins that will transport nutrients to that through that plasma membrane, just like humans. So that's their exposure to the world. And they're sensing all that. And here it is. So here we have, see, carbon dioxide and nitrogen and oxygen are permeable through that. Alcohols can go through. Urea goes through that. Suddenly something that rings a bell with you. Urea. Urea is a non-charged ion. So it can move through. In fact, urea is used in a lot of cosmetics for women because the urea will help pull the nutrient into the skin. And it helps pull things into that plasma membrane. Even water is somewhat controlled by these transporters called aquaporons. They're channeled gates that allow water to move through the plasma membrane very, very quickly. When it's short, it can sort of gobble up a lot. And when it's not short, it'll shut down. Those were discovered in 1991. That's how recently we developed it. But it's impermeable to glucose. It's impermeable to all these cations and anions, and it's impermeable to amino acids. That's why it can control what is going on in the cell, because it's like wrapped in an envelope with only portals through it into the cell that it can control. And that's the genetic control that provides that security to the cell and eventually brings it to a state of homeostasis. So there's different kinds of portals, and we can't get into it, but there's passive transport. There's active transport where some things go through one way, other things can come in this way, and they can go in both directions. Just to give you, for sure an idea that this is true, because 10 years ago, I didn't know this and I couldn't believe it. Been a long time since I've been to school. Nobody was telling me this stuff. So this is a diagrammatic representation. Here's that plasma membrane, and you can see there's all these portals, and here's the vacuole and all these transporters here. So when the plasma membrane is overloaded, say a root hits a sideband, suddenly you got nutrients pouring in like mad. And if the plant doesn't do something, they can be toxic. So in the root system, what it does, it takes that and it moves it into the vacuole. And it stores it there because the vacuole has a lower pH. So it can take this toxic material and it can expand. So you can store all this stuff in there. When the plant then needs it, these transporters, look over here on the right, these transporters can now move it back in. For example, there's a calcium transporter, magnesium transporter, sucrose transporter. And up here, because we're getting nutrients, there's a nitrate transporter, phosphorus transporter, potassium transporter, sugar transporter. Get the message? The plant is controlling this. Here, metals, iron, manganese, zinc, cadmium. When the vacuole runs out of nutrients, because the cytoplasm here has utilized it all for energy, for photosynthesis. Got hidden hunger, man. You don't see that happen till that vacuole has run out of juice. So what does the plant do? This is the last of it, and you'll have a pretty good handle on things. You've recently heard about messenger RNA in terms of COVID, eh? So we're using a messenger RNA vaccine to give us immunity. Yeah, plants the same darn way. Would you believe it? So we have this cell, could be root cell, could be a stem cell, could be any kind of cell. They're all basically the same with genetic material. Each cell is the same. It's got different functions in different places, a little bit different abilities. So the plasma membrane senses something. So it's got to do something. Can't run, can't hide. It's got 40, 50,000 genes. You know, the human being runs on about 22, 23,000 genes. You know, canola, 50 to 60,000. The whole wheat Johnny genome is 105,000 if you take all the wheat species that we know of. So, you know, it's got a lot of genes on there. And these genes are all hiding over here in the DNA, in these strands of DNA. And, you know, there's a bunch of genes that are sitting there. And these DNA is made with a phosphorus right here. And it's got a sugar. And these are all nitrogen compounds in here. So NP, man. Don't ever run out of N and P, because then the cells can't make themselves. They can't make a complete cell. But anyhow, back to what the plant does. So it's got to go over to the gene, and it looks for a gene, and we'll just use phosphorus because phosphorus is important. It says, well, you know, I got a gene siding in here somewhere that helps me get phosphorus. I need to put some citric acid and some malic acid out into my rhizosphere through my root here. You know, and I'm going to do that. So I go to my gene and I find that gene and I make a copy of it with messenger RNA. And that's produced here in the nucleus. So I make a copy, which is I unravel this DNA and I make a copy of one strand and I take it and I carry it and I put it into these little machines called ribosomes here. And the ribosome is an amazing thing. It takes that copy of that protein, and it just makes a whole bunch of them real fast, real fast. Then it puts in the endoplasmic reticulum and runs it around here and sticks it into that plasma membrane. And lo and behold, now we got all these enzymes and so on going into the rhizosphere through portals out into the system to help me extract that phosphorus and get it into the plant. After I do that, after the plant does that, it has to downregulate that, so to speak, or shut it down. So then different genes bring in other messenger RNA that runs them through the ribosomes again to downregulate it and stops. Well, there it is. That's how it does it. And depending on what it senses, it changes its genes or it selects its genes. It doesn't change its genes. What am I talking about? It goes to its genetic pool and it finds what it needs. Now, we just finished a study here with a partner of ours. We looked at the proteome. In other words, we look at the genes produce proteins. And all of these things are proteins that we're talking about. So we wanted to see what was happening in terms of the proteins that were being produced when we treated the plant with something. And these were 14-day-old canola plants. And when we did a proteome analysis of how many proteins were in the root of that 14-day plant, there were 9,600 proteins already produced in the root of that 14-day canola plant. So the proteins are produced, and the proteins actually can be changed after translation. So anyhow, here's the simple part on how this all happens. The plasma membrane receives a signal. Could be a hormonal signal, could be environmental signal in the plasma membrane from somewhere. The reaction is produced and a second message is transmitted and is transduced into the cell. And calcium is quite frequently involved as a second messenger I mentioned earlier. And that activates a cellular response, to put it very simply, which is a cellular response with a genetic upregulation of something to take care of what's happening. And as a result, we get all of these different things different proteins, different transporters. We can, for example, just to show you this, we get a sulfate transporter, an ammonium transporter, put on my glasses, and a nitrate transporter planted in here. We even have things called HATs and LATs, high affinity transport systems and low affinity transport systems. When there's lots of nutrient, it doesn't have to expend energy. If there isn't much nutrient there, we got to use ATP to bring in things, and we can pump out hydrogen here. As you can see, we got a positive on the outside of the plasma membrane and a negative charge, which gives us energy across that membrane, and we can move things in. And sometimes we got to move the hydrogen out or partner with what's coming in order to get it in. So the plant is regulating the electronic system as well as the nutrient system inside of it. And in this case, it's bringing in inorganic P, and the plant only uses inorganic P. So out here in the rhizosphere, for example, in the root, we have a lot of that phosphorus that is organic phosphorus. In other words, organisms are after that P in that soil, in the rhizosphere. So it's gobbling up that phosphorus. The fungi are, the soil microbes, the bacteria, everything are eating them, and then they die. Now they are organic P. So the plant has to extract that organic P or inorganic P in order to use it. And that's what happens. Plus, we have to get this all into the plant, all of these. And you can see that 96% of everything in the plant is carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And carbon is the key, and hydrogen and oxygen, because all the molecules are made from those. But carbon is the backbone. We're a carbon life on this earth. Without carbon, we can't make molecules. So, you know, that's going to happen. And that's why we have photosynthesis. The most important process on the earth is photosynthesis. Without it, we can't get carbon into plants or animals effectively. Some microbes can, algae can, and so on. But basically, that's the source of life, is carbon. And plants do that for us as well as give us oxygen. So plants are what keep this earth going. But let's talk about the other nutrients, because we can't do much about that unless you believe we're getting into, you know, people are worried about getting too much carbon and carbon dioxide. And that's a whole nother story. Our plants would love that. At one time during the Triassic time periods, when dinosaurs roamed all over Alberta and Saskatchewan, Montana and Colorado, carbon dioxide was 1,200 parts per million. We're just somewhere in the 300 to 400 parts per million now. So we can, we got a little way to go. Now, a couple of things I just want to point out here. Nitrogen is used the most because we need a lot of it there to build all those amino acids. But phosphorus and potassium, or phosphorus is the next. The next total amount is potassium, then followed by calcium, then by phosphorus. The volumes are much greater of these, but this is just as important or more important. But a lot of people always think that phosphorus is the next large volume. And you notice that calcium is key in there, because all that calcium goes in the cell wall. Potassium drives everything, the osmotic pressure, the enzyme activity, those kinds of things. The sulfur is used for a lot of things, and I'll spend lots of time on sulfur and potassium in the next session. I also want to point out these transition metals, they're called, Well, first of all, they're metals. Iron, manganese, zinc, copper, molybdenum, nickel. Boron isn't a metal. It's somewhere in between a metal. Chlorine, we're not going to talk about a whole lot. It's necessary for several things, and especially stomatal closure, and I'll cover that in a little while. Now, the beauty of these is these are involved in enzymes, just like your car's catalytic converter. These are the enzymes that allow the plant to function and do things really quickly in terms of making molecules, making proteins, and those kinds of things. And they're also involved in dealing with those bad guys, the reactive oxygen species, in terms of getting rid of them. Because if we got an electron problem, we need metals, because they're called transition metals, because they can vary their valence and move and give up and take electrons. And copper or zinc is always included, even though it never changes its valence. So we'll talk about those. But those are very difficult to get, and they're limited in our soils, because unless we break down more soil, we're extracting it very quickly. They don't need much, but one thing to point out, essential minerals, essential nutrients. In other words, a plant can't complete its life cycle without all of them. Plus, we need photosynthesis. We need water. We need oxygen. This is the repeat. We need CO2 in. We need transpiration. And we combine that all and we get early rooting. We get early chlorophyll. We improve water use efficiency and nutrient efficiency, more yield. The leaf is your solar panel that absorbs that, and it also controls the transpiration or loss. What's coming in, what's going out is all controlled by the leaf and the stomata through the control of water. And sunlight drives it all. It's the energy source. The sunlight heating the leaf increases transpiration because water can absorb that, and it's going to keep the plant cool. It also provides the electron stimulation for energy and electron transport. So let's take a look at photosynthesis now. And you have to remember this. Here's chlorophyll, magnesium, surrounded by 4 nitrogen. Here's photosynthesis. You're not going to see any of these things because they're all microscopic, basically, and you'll have to just believe me. The first thing that happens in photosynthesis is water enters the chloroplast. And here we get the electron transport where the sun energizes the transport system. And this O2 now gives off the oxygen as a waste product. Thank heavens for that. And the hydrogen is used to eventually form ATP here through something called ATP synthase. So all we get out of photosynthesis is a little bit of ATP produced here, which then goes over to this thing called the Calvin-Benson cycle, where CO2 from the air is taken in and converted to sugar. That's it. The end product of photosynthesis is sugar. It's taken those carbon molecules, which are the source of the backbone of production of everything, along with the oxygen that is there, and the hydrogen from here, from water, produces glucose. And it's done through this enzyme called Rubisco. And here's a diagram of Rubisco, which stands for ribulose biphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. Now, I've had to memorize that, but, you know, it's not a big fancy thing. It's just that I like to tell people what it does, because this protein is the protein that is produced on this earth in the greatest amount every day, because every plant on the face of the earth, including some aquatic organisms, use Rubisco for that process. And one of the key molecules, atoms in it, ions in it, is magnesium, as well as in chlorophyll. And magnesium is also key in terms of ATP. ATP is almost activated in most cases by magnesium. So magnesium is key in many, many responses. The other reason I tell you what this is because carboxylase implies that it can handle CO2, which it does. The oxygenase implies that if there isn't CO2, it will take oxygen as this enzyme, it ends in ACE, and it will try to use oxygen, and that's called photorespiration. So when the stomata close and there's no water, the oxygen is trapped. There's no CO2 coming in. The plant suffers quite badly, and it cycles this oxidative respiration, causing damage to the oxygens that are trapped in the plant. And this is simple. Here's water coming in and oxygen cranked out. Photosystem 2 gets energized, and you get an electron transferred here to the cytochromes, you don't have to worry about that. And then it's transferred to photosystem 2 by something called plastocyanin. And this is really important, and I'm going to show you that. And the electron is transferred here. Then it's transferred here into forming NADP, which is, don't worry about that, by something called ferrodioxin. Whenever you've seen ferro, that means iron. And then here's the ATP synthase, and it takes ADP, adds an inorganic phosphorus to it, and you get ATP, and that's used in the Benson cycle. So let's look at that. Just so you know, the first thing that has to happen is the water molecule has to be broken. What does it take? It takes this. Manganese and calcium. And it breaks the water molecule. That's the first step. So you need manganese there all the time. Remember what I talked about before in terms of seed germination? Manganese is really important. First step, breaking down water. Plasticizing, that's the first electron transport. Copper, 30% of the copper in a plant is used exclusively for this process. So that's why we didn't see a bunch of differences in all those plants with copper, simply because they had adequate amounts and they all use a lot of it. And it also includes methionine, which is sulfur, and nitrogen. Ferredoxin, the last one in the transfer, iron plus sulfur again, and these are cysteine amino acids as well. So we have iron, copper, and manganese here in the electron transport system, and you will see in the next session that manganese, copper, iron, and zinc are key to management of the stress, even though this process creates the reactive oxygen species as well. Interesting. And here's ATP. Again, never run out of phosphorus, no matter what, because without P, phosphorus, without ATP, which is energy, you got nothing going for you. Makes everything. So that little process of CO2 plus water plus light giving you sugar makes everything. Complex sugars, amino acids, proteins, fats, vitamins, and so on. Just that simple. When photosynthesis and respiration are interrupted, every process and function in a plant is affected, and it's driven by water. So what is water use efficiency? Well, if CO2 is the really driving force, it's got to be how much water does it take to process a molecule of CO2? With C3 plants, which are most of the plants we grow, which stands for carbon 3, the first molecule produced out of the usual carbon dioxide is a 3-carbon molecule. So it takes 400 molecules of water to process one CO2 molecule. Corn, on the other hand, only uses 150 molecules of water to process one molecule of CO2. 67.67% efficient. Not that great, but it's a whole lot better than this. So corn will always outgrow anything we're going to produce unless we can convert C3 plants to C4 plants. And the difference is that C4 plants have a more stable and a different kind of photosynthesis that doesn't involve that oxygen problem that C3 plants have. So now the fun begins. So how does the plant get water and nutrients? Well, it comes in through the root, goes in by diffusion and active transport here into the xylem, up the xylem, here through the tissue, the vascular system, out here, and the process goes on and drags the nutrients up there. But what does that really look like? And before I get to that. And the sources, let's take a look at source. So we have sources as seed, sources the tuber, storage roots can be sources, and leaves are a source. And the sinks can be the same roots, can be the flowers, can be the pods, can be the seed, and it can be new leaves that are being developed, or those are the sinks. So before we get to water, let's take a look at how the plant moves those sugars. So here we have a cell, sugar being produced. We're going to load the phloem because the phloem moves the sugars. The xylem moves water generally, the phloem moves sugars. And we say, xylem up, phloem down. So what happens is the sugars are moved through these plasmodesmata to what are called companion cells, which are live cells, which then move it into the phloem through plasmodesmata. So we get a concentration of solutes here. When we have a concentration of solutes and a plasma membrane, water will move from a high concentration to this lower concentration, and that's called osmosis. That osmosis puts pressure on here, and it moves the phloem down through these elements to the sink. This is the sink. So there's high pressure here, and the sink is pulling the sugars here, so there's low pressure here. So that, as well as gravity, is moving it, and it's moving down. But this water that was going up the xylem, there are pits in the xylem, that water was pulled in to provide the pressure to pressurize that. And then once this is pulled out, the water is given back off, and this is moved back into the xylem, not by differential water pressures, potentials, but by transpiration, and the water is recycled in the plant. So you can see the dilemma we continue to have when we get the stomata closed and respiration or photosynthesis blocked. We can't move nutrients. We can't move photosynthates and sugars through the plant because we can't pressurize it. We can't make any more. We can't get rid of it, and therefore the plant is stalled. So here's just an example of how osmotic pressure works, where you have the xylem here with a lot of water, and over here we got a lot of those solutes. So in fact, because of this plasma membrane, we get that water that will be drawn into the phloem to pressurize it. That's what trigger pressures, and that's what drives the stomata, and it also drives the expansion of the cells. Potassium is involved. So potassium is over here in larger concentrations. So it, by osmotic pressure, will pull in water from surrounding it into there to expand that from other cells around it, as those cells are full and can be replenished by the transpiration flow. And that movement of all these sugars, and this is a shot of the phloem in soybeans, and you can see it's full of sugars, is called translocation. So let's look at those pipes. So here's a root of wheat. You can see this, the rhizosphere here, and the soil that's hanging on by the root hairs. And then these are the big holes are the xylem, and then the phloems around it. So here it's moving up through the stem, and this is now soybeans, and this is soybean, and here's wheat. You can see the same thing, wheat's hollow, of course. And you can see all these portals here are water transferring nutrients. This is soybean, and this is cut across the leaf just after the petiole. So this is the main vein coming in here, and these are the smaller venules. You can see them here. And here's what it looks like. So you got the same holes here and the same holes here. So going on, here's wheat. You can see, I always look like somebody's looking at you whenever I do this in wheat, and you can see it move. So we have that coming all the way from the root tip up into the veins, into the venules, moving through the veins everywhere to the tip. And then what? Well, I'll show you next, but let me ask you this. What's the oldest part of a leaf? I'll tell you because I can't see you. It's the tip. So when you see things happening at the tip, tells you something, it's killing the cells. If you're killing cells here, you got to start at the tip because you don't want to kill these veins here and veins here because you're going to pull those nutrients out. So when you see damage occurring at the tip, that's telling you that the plant is killing those cells. And when the plant kills cells, it's killing it to take nutrients and move them. So it can do that early in life of the plant. So what's in the cells? Well, the chloroplasts are in the cells, the rubiscos in the cells, all that nitrogen is in the cells, all that phosphorus from the genetic materials in the cells, all that magnesium is in the cells. So what can a plant translocate from its lower leaves into its top leaves? Nitrogen, phosphorus, magnesium, and potassium. And the potassium is what drives a lot of that movement. So that explains why those nutrients can be remobilized from the lower leaves, because that's what they're made of and they're mobile. Things like copper get stuck behind necessarily. Manganese gets stuck behind. They're not soluble. They're not easily moved. So we have to have them coming through the root all the time to reach higher into the plant. So the water is here. It vaporizes in these spongy cells here. So the vapor, the stomata open, and wind blows it away, and there's transpiration. So these are stomata of wheat. You can see it's on the bottom of the leaf. These are all the stomata. And you can see that when we get leaf diseases, One of the damages is, of course, prevention of stomatal opening and closing, and that's really key to regulation of water. And, you know, the plant regulates water, again, by that source sink issue in the apical meristem and of the root and shoot, because the root is the one that is sensing the water. So when it's out of water, it sends up some abscisic acid to the stomata and, you know, says, oh, close them, or crying out loud, because I haven't got enough water down here. So here's a closer shot, and you can see that here's the stomata and there's the portal here, the opening, and these guard cells around them are the real thing. So you can see them. Unfortunately, I've done my best to photograph blasted stomata on dicots, and they're very small, so I can't really see them there, but I'll just show you. So how is water controlled? Well, let's take a day in the life of a plant. At night, the plant goes to sleep. The stomata are closed. Some of the sugar produced in the daytime is used by the mitochondria to give energy to the plant, because it's got to live through the night. So if you use more energy at night than you make during the day, you don't go anywhere. So long rainy periods, long cloudy periods mean your plant can stall for a long period of time because it's not making enough blasted sugar to compensate for the respiration that takes place during the night and during the day as well. So in the morning, the blue light in the sun, roughly between 440 and 490 nanometers, triggers sensors in the stomata, in the guard cells. And here's I just found this more recently. So here are wheat or monocot stomatal guard cells, and these are dicots. So, they're about the same, except when these are squashed or blown up, they're like beams, so they pop open, and that's what opens the stomata here, moves them out. These are, and on the right side, the microfibrils, when it's filled up with water and so on, they expand and open the cell. So let's take a look at what happens. Here it's closed, okay? So to open it, what happens is potassium and chloride move in from the subsidiary cells into the guard cells. And I don't think I outlined. These subsidiary cells contain water, and they also contain potassium and chloride and calcium and those kinds of things. So what happens? The potassium and chloride go in, which increases trigger pressure because of the solutes in there, and it pulls in water, and it starts opening. So water goes in. It opens. To close, what we have is ABA, abscisic acid binding on here. We kick out the chlorides, we kick out the potassiums, and the water flows out, the trigger pressure is lost, and it closes. And here's how it works diurnally. The plant senses that blue light, and the guard cells have their own chloroplast, so they can produce energy, and ribosomes and so on. So they can produce energy. That opens the aperture, the pore, the stomata, and by about 1 o'clock, she's done. The potassium increases there, which drives the opening, and then it sort of peels off by 1 o'clock and then closes by night. But by then, the sugars are being produced, and then that drives the continued opening of the stomata for CO2. And then as sunlight comes on and goes down, it closes. So that potassium, along with the chlorides and some of the other osmolites, are key to opening and closing that. So nutrients and water uptake now. Roots, one of my favorites. I've spent more time looking at roots and photographing roots, but some really interesting stuff if you have time to look like I do. Here's a showing roots, and this is really quite interesting. It surprised me. Take a look at roots, and they measure it in kilometers per meter square. So, you know, gosh, somebody figured this all out. Barley roots, 5.3. Faba beans, look at that. That big plant, only 2.9 compared to barley plants. Not a big root. I noticed that legumes have relatively small roots. Maize, corn, 15. Potatoes, 8.7. Look at our good friend, Mr.
rapeseed canola. I said, I wonder we grow that plant here. 28. Soybeans, small root. Wheat, another big root. Oh, listen, if you want to grow stuff on the prairies where it's relatively dry and erratic, you want to grow a plant with big roots. What two plants do we grow a lot of? Is that coincidental? No, it's because of the roots. So I'll talk more about this in the next session. But basically what happens is mass flow moves the mobile nutrients to the plant just in the water, and then various portals can bring it in. And we'll just leave it at that. Diffusion, things like phosphorus, large amount of potassium, and all the micronutrients to a degree only move a tiny, tiny distance because there isn't much there. So there isn't a lot of a gradient in between there. And that's where plants have strategies. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And then root interception, that means where the plant just bumps into them. So if the plant isn't growing and moving because it hasn't got water, hasn't got energy, it can't get any of those. Now, one thing that's interesting is if you take a look at a root hair, and here's a root here. I said it's a single cell. It's got a nucleus, and it's out there, and it varies. And canola is another great thing because the canola root hair is about 1.3 millimeters long, and that's almost twice the size of, say, a wheat or a legume root hair. So canola has much longer root hairs, and that's really key to why it can extract nutrients and water so efficiently and just gobble up everything. But just think of it this way. Water has to be connected to water in order to flow. So as we take out water out of the macromolecules around in the soil and we remove that water, all that's left is a film around the edge of that macromolecule. So the flow of water reduces the water potential. There isn't as great as it used to be, so we get less water moving to the root. So what happens is the plant puts out smaller roots that goes next into the micromolecules, micropores, and extracts nutrients there, because there we have the stream, and the drier and drier it gets and the more air that is now in the soil, the less water the plant can get. So how do plants get nutrients? Well, they can kick them off. Plants respire, they produce CO2. When they pump that into the rhizosphere, that reacts with water, produce carbonic acid. That can dissociate, producing hydrogens, which then are attracted to the negative cation exchange on the clay particle. And if we put enough on, it kicks off the cations that are there. And the easiest one to kick off is potassium because it's got a single charge, you know. And next one that's a little bit harder to kick off is magnesium. And calcium isn't held on nearly as easily. So that's what it does. And then those go into the liquid flow. And as we have a negative water pressure here compared to the soil, that is attracted to there, you know, by diffusion. And once it's at the root, it can be moved into the plant and by transpiration moved up into the shoot. Now, things like phosphorus, which only move by diffusion, the plants have figured out strategies how to deal with that. So what they can do, they form associations with mycorrhizae, which can grow into much smaller micropores and over greater distance and can bring back both phosphorus and other micronutrients as well as water. So we have mycorrhizal associations and transporters. They can secrete organic acids and phosphatases into the rooting zone like citric acid, malic acid, to extract nutrients from the organic matter and the mineral matter. And so they can grow more lateral roots. They can grow longer root hairs. They do that all genetically. They can grow adventitious roots. They can increase transporters to pick it up. They can re-jig or remove phosphorus from lower leaves into other plants, and they do that genetically and hormonally in the plant, just like we basically showed you before. Now, this is a mycorrhizae for you guys that aren't familiar with them. Taurus does sell these into the marketplace, and you can see something really cool, because in this mycorrhizae, if you look closely, you can see molecule moves are moving in both directions in the hyphae. This is the spore which it germinates, and you can see activity here. So the spore is getting nutrients and picking up nutrients and putting back into the system. So the plant is feeding carbon through the mycorrhizae, just like they do to other organisms in the rhizosphere. And the plant is sending back materials and phosphorus, water, back to the root, a happy symbiosis. This is very common. One interesting thing is the crucifers don't have a mycorrhizal relationship. So canola doesn't have mycorrhizae. And in fact, the year after canola, we should probably be adding mycorrhizae because it, in fact, breaks down and is detrimental to mycorrhizae. So guys that are using 2 and 3 year row, you know, continuous canola are really impacting their mycorrhizal activity. So that's how certain plants are able to change things. Now here's a root. I described it already. The root here, maturation zone, elongation zone, root cap, and meristematic stuff. And this root cap here, which protects it and also gives off all these sugars so that as the root moves through them, microbes are living on this, and then it extracts nutrients that the microbes themselves make available to the root hairs way back here as they live in association with the root in that rhizosphere, that tight chunk right around the root. And the plant, I think, controls what is there by the exudates that it puts into that rhizosphere. So at the root hair itself, what happens in terms of nutrients, and the plant controls that, is they have two choices. They can go into the air spaces here in between the cells, move through here, move through here, move through here, until they reach something called a Casparian strip, right here. It's subarized waxy. It can't go through, so it's got to go through a plasmodesmata into the cell, and then it can go into the xylem, into the vasculature, and be moved. Or it can go directly through the plasmodesmata from cell to cell to cell and into the root. Just kind of like this. Chunk, 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 chunk. And here's the endodermis moved into the pericycle, which is where new lateral roots are formed, right next to the xylem. And then plants have their own architecture. They can change that architecture. Now here we got, you know, winter wheat, which is growing at about a 45 degree angle, and we can change that architecture. Here's an architecture that grows everywhere. Now, drought brings on length of the primary roots, but reduces lateral roots. That's an interesting statement. So why would that make sense? Well, we got all these lateral roots here sucking nutrients and water up here where they want to be in the top 10 inches. I mean, cry out loud. You don't want to go down deeper than 10 inches in most soils because there's nothing much there. There's small compaction. So the pores are small. It's hard to get through. There's no oxygen. The nutrients are limited because unless they've been leached down there, it costs a lot of energy to build that root. They don't want to go down there, and they have to get water. And in fact, they've already got a trick figured out, because as they go down, they subarize behind them. Here, otherwise the plant would just take up all the water up here close. They wouldn't bother taking it over here to tips. So by subarizing this and preventing water from entering, it forces the plant to get nutrients and water from the root tips, because the root tips are what are growing. This isn't growing. If it just did this alone, it would never kind of move there and it would eventually die. So the plant is also subarizing it to prevent the loss of water, because we can get hydraulic lift. In other words, there's root pressure here, which goes here and it forces out here, and we can lose some into here for sure. So we can bring water up into those rooting zones. So when it's dried, they go down and they pull nutrients and water down here. You wonder, if it didn't have that, they would just be trying to continue to pull it here. You can only put so much suction on a system to get it to kind of move the water up through transpiration. And the plant controls where that takes place. The lateral roots are put on. It's controlled by ethylene and brassinosteroids and auxins and so on. And here, just to show, this is the pericycle.
and the cells start developing just, and then you get a lateral root coming out. The same thing happens with rhizobium and legumes. The plant grows the nodule, and that happens here. These are like stem cells as well, where nodules form, and this is where lateral roots are. And the balance between auxins, ABA, and cytokinins out of the root, and this from the shoot, determine where the lateral root's going to grow. And here's what it looks like. This is a faba bean, and you can see that the lateral roots are coming right here next to the vasculature from that pericycle, and they're moving out. And you can see the cells are opening, and the lateral root is growing out, and wow, out she comes. And if you cut back into it, you can see that that lateral root goes all the way back here to the pericycle. So once nutrients and water move into here, it's got a clean pattern right into there. There's nothing to stop it. So here's our best root scavenger, this canola plant. Look at how it grows. It puts its big roots right up here where all the nutrients and most of the water is going to be. But it can take nutrients like a dart. Long root hairs. It can search it out. This is mid-row banding. It knows where the nutrients are, and when it gets there, it puts on a good time. This is a canola root, 7 days old, extracting phosphorus from a crystal green granule. Put out three lateral roots into there and just melted that granule. Here's some shots showing toxicity for you guys. This is toxic here from urea. Notice the tips get burnt off. Here, it's a good shot here. Just like lungs get burnt off from anhydrous ammonia. There's nothing protecting them, so that urea becomes overwhelming and melts the cells. But you know what? Roots grow in all directions. Seminal roots grow in all directions. So these were burnt off. All this one, they just put on a whole bunch of lateral roots, and it looked like it's going to make it. Here's one I turned away, and here's one I just shot the other day. This is a new potassium product that's actually a stone. And you can see that the roots are melting and growing into that and extracting nutrients. So the root hairs are really the key, but you don't want to have this. And this can happen. The two worst ones from my experience are boron. 10% or 15% granule in the seed row is really a dangerous venture. It'll melt those roots in excessive amounts of urea in the seed row. And I'm finding that more and more farmers are reducing stuff going in the seed row and wanting low salt index stuff going in there. Well, now we're getting down to the easy part on the way to the end. And we're going to just take a look at this whole source sink thing. And do you ever think about it? That the seed is the source to start, and it's the sink at the end. So it's all about the seed. Ah, isn't that cool? And I want to take a look at seed, because not enough guys talk about seed. So here's wheat, and I like wheat, and I'll show you other things. So wheat, you know, if you're going to grow seed, you want to pick seed that the mother plant has made good seed, big seeds. So let's take a look at what happens. Here's a wheat plant. Take a look. Pollination starts here in the middle. So what do we get? We get four seeds, three seeds, four seeds, three, three, two, 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 two. The tiller, we don't want any of those seeds. Look at them. Puny, twos and ones, so we don't want them. And if we look at this set of seeds, in fact, even from here where it's just after pollination, these two seeds are the first ones to be pollinated, followed by this one, in the middle. These seeds get the most nutrient first because they were the first ones pollinated, and that's the plant that's got the most nutrient available unless they've been droughted out, something terrible. So I want these three seeds, the big seeds. Put it on a gravity, clean it out, throw the rest into the bin and sell it. And when you get a seed, I find this kind of interesting because here's how a seed germinates. First of all, it takes in water and starts respiring. And the first thing it has to do is fix everything. It's got to fix its mitochondria. It's got to do a bunch of transcription and produce some new messenger RNA to make some new proteins and the mitochondria synthesis. So there's a lag there. It takes in water, you get respiration, starts off, and then 2-3 days. And then boom, we get that all fixed up, and then we get taking off and we start remobilizing all of that seed. And I want to show you what that looks like. Oops.
I want to go back. There we go. Okay. Hang on. There. What? Oh, okay, here we are. So here's what's happening. And this is a seed I cut and shot. And I'll show you. Here's the actual embryo, which we would call the germ. And here's something called the scutellum. Now, the way a seed germinates is after it takes in water, it forms a node on the scutellum here. And that's where the new shoot comes out and the new root. So you can see that this has already consumed some of the starches in here. So, okay, we're back to where we were. Here's a cross section of a wheat kernel. And the important thing is this red line. You see it here, and you can see it here. That's called the aleuron. That is alive. This is all dead. And the germ is alive. And you can see the aleuron in here, because that's important in terms of what happens germination-wise. So we have the endosperm, which is all the sugars lined up together become a starch, and there are various sizes of starch and different kinds of starch. So here's what happens in germination. When you get in that water and you get some respiration going on, the scutellum produces gibberellin, which down-regulates the abscisic acid, which is responsible for keeping the plant dormant. That brings about the production of alpha amylase in that little red line called the aleuron that's alive. That produces that enzyme which starts breaking down the starch to glucose and sugars, and it also produces proteases to break down the proteins that are stored in there. That is then fed into the scutellum here to feed the growing shoot. Lo and behold, here's alpha amylase. It's got a bunch of calcium in it. So let's take a look at something. I'm a believer that if we look at the seed, that will tell us the quality of seed, but maybe more importantly, and we got a big study going on. Okay, there. Am I okay now?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're good.
How that happened. Take a look at the seed, because this is stuff from southern Saskatchewan. And you can see that the boron levels are low, the zinc levels are low, the copper levels are low. Now, to me, that's telling me that this seed may not be that good for germination. But more importantly, I think we can use this to have the plant tell us what the plant was not able to get during its growing season. So this is what we're looking at right now. But you can see the boron levels and the zinc levels. And I've looked at a bunch of samples from down there on durum wheat, and they all look exactly the same. Because southern Saskatchewan, the southwest, is short of zinc. And that's just the way it is. Now, so we have the plant now using the starches. And there's two basic starches. There, this is the amylopectins, which are high glycemic index stuff because it's got a lot of molecules that can be chewed on by enzymes. And we have amylose. So the plant has different kinds of nutrients in the endosperm to support it during germination. Now, here's the only slide I've ever been able to find where a person took enough time to break the plant into components. And look at what you find. The embryo is only 2% of the dry matter, but look at the content. Zinc, manganese, boron, potassium, phosphorus, all of it, high levels in the germination. That's why we have a good idea that zinc and manganese are key for vigor in the seedling. And then we have a lot of it here, which is pulled on later, but these are really key micronutrients. The seed coat, in many cases, doesn't provide a whole lot. Other than the potassium, it moves, quite a bit of potassium in. And here's just a shot of the zinc where it concentrates, right here in the germ, and right here in the aleuron. This is Dr. Chakmak's
photograph. So here's the same thing going on. Now take a look here. I pulled that whole scutellum off with the coleoptile, looked inside. This is like after 2 days of water put to it, 3 days. The first true leaf is already alive and growing that fast because the mother plant already primed that seed before she put it to sleep the previous fall. So here we got it, the coleoptile coming up. You can see root hairs are growing. There's some bunch of them growing here. I floated out in water. The coleoptile comes up, the tip opens, and there's your first true leaf up and going. This coleoptile protected it coming through the ground. Those cells were growing vertically. Stage 31, first node above the ground. The seed head is already there. The seed head is born, produced below ground, comes up above the first node. Stage 31, that's when typically you would start putting on manipulator. That's at the five-leaf stage. That's how early this is formed. At this point in time, all the seeds possible are there and we're protecting them going forward. The last stage. Vegetative versus reproductive part. Remember I said during the vegetative part, they're growing all this stuff, but when we hit to a reproductive part, things change. Boron levels go up, zinc levels go up, manganese go up in the reproductive part, copper and calcium big time because of the stigma and the pollen tube. Now, most mortality or lack of seed set occurs because of pollen, inappropriate produced pollen, not because the ovule died, but the pollen was poor. Heat stress causes a lot of pollen loss, and that's why we know things like canola and other plants get poor seed set because you got all these seeds that have to be set so they can be really interfered with during heat stroke. Now, I want to show you something. This is something I did this year where I took canola and I looked at where the nutrients were in the plant when it was going into flower. So I took the bottom leaves on the rosette, and here's what I found. I found N was low, P was low. Really good, because the plant was in fact doing what it's supposed to. It's moving its phosphorus and nitrogen from the lower leaves to the next leaves. I took the leaves from the top of the rosette. N was still, you know, there was still a fair amount there. Potassium, there was still amount there. Boron was low, but, you know, it was there. And copper was a bit low. So it's moving some of that, maybe. I'm not sure all the time that we can't move copper. But then I took the buds. And look what I found. In the same plants, same group of plants, I partitioned them. They're all fine, except for potassium. But potassium had already done its job of moving those nutrients up into the shoot. Now, if we believe that things like manganese, iron, and copper are not able to move them out of the lower plants, that means the plant was moving the nutrients from the root system up into there and bypassing putting anything into the leaf. And if you were just doing the leaves, you would say, I got a deficiency in these plants. But if you went to the actual buds, it might be that the buds are preferentially getting all of these metals because the plant needs it and the plant's controlling it and not moving any to the leaves and pulling what it can from the leaves. Now, I use this to show you almost lastly pollen, because this is corn and they're big. So these are the anthers in corn, and you can see that the pollen has to be fed. So it sits on the tissue in the anther, and that's the same everywhere. So if you get a shortage of water, you get shortage of nutrients, you can't have the pollen properly matured in order to pollinate it. And that starts early. This is a cross-section of corn, and you can see how many leaves are left to unfurl. So this is really early, and you can already have all of that formed in the canola, in the corn plant. So let's take a look at pollination. So the pollen grain lands on this stigma. It germinates, takes in some nutrient, and it feeds in this styler tissue. Pollen tube goes down.
to the seed. The seed splits the sperm into two because there's double pollination. The pollen tube enters the micropyle. And here we got the egg. So it drops off one of its sperm here with the center grid, which then helps it get into the egg. And the other one moves over here to the central cell and produces the endosperm. And that is controlled by calcium fluctuations at the tip and pH fluctuations that drive it, and probably hormones that attract it to the micropyle. And here's where the calcium is. The high concentration of calcium at the tip is important for building this cell wall along with the boron in order to prevent it from busting and to allow the sperm to move down and pollinate the plant. And if it's short of those things, it may be key to why we don't get it. Now here we have canola. These are buds. And I want to point out something to you. This is a bud. As soon as you see the buds in that rosette, everything is produced. The anthers are there. The stigma's there. The seeds are there. Look at this. The seeds are already there. So if you're thinking that in that early stage when the rosette is forming that you don't have to be concerned about nutrients, man, you got to be really concerned about nutrients at that point in time, because you got to feed all that to get it growing. And if you're in that upward curve, there's a lot of fighting going on for all those sugars that are being produced in that plant, because the leaves need it, the roots need it, everything needs it. And if you don't have enough, something is going to give. And that's where you get loss of those buds. Here are peas. Same thing. There's usually two or three peas in the cluster. And you can see in this one, there's mature pollen, less mature pollen, and green pollen. And here's what it looks like. You can see here's the stigma. And you can see that this is the flower isn't even open because it's closed pollination anyway, but it hasn't even got any pollen out. You can see there's the pod right there below it. Now you can see that the pollen is on here. It's growing pollen tubes and pollinating all of these seeds. If one doesn't get pollinated, it's a blank. The ovule is a blank. Just that simple. Canola. This is the tip of a stigma of canola. And you can see it's full of all these vesicles here with nutrients, sugars, and so on. And here's a pollen grain. This is the most amazing shot I have. And yet it's so simple. But this pollen grain, and there's the pollen tube, I was pushed up, and that's the pollen tube growing down. And here are the trails of the pollen grains and the pollen tubes that went down this stigma to try and form seed. So that's how that works. And lastly, wheat. So here's wheat. And I always ask people, well, what happens when the head emerges? And they say, well, it pollinates. Well, no, not quite. Notice that the head protrudes. It's expanded upwards. And it doesn't really pollinate until after it's expanded to its full length, except when it's scorching hot and it's forced to. So here's what happens. The same thing. Here's the anther. Here's the stigma. The ovaries down below. Very small, very green, maturing as it goes. The stigma opens and gets all these juices on it. The anther opens, the pollen comes out, poof. It's attracted to the stigma because of hydrophilic activity, where the pollen is dried, it's attracted to it, and it's just covered in pollen grains. And only one of them has to go to a seed to form it. Kicks out the pollen, the anthers after it's done. And here we go. We're basically done. We get these seeds. They grow through this stage, mature, end result, dead plant, seed to seed. One last thing for you guys that like to get your proteins up in wheat. The last time you have an opportunity to increase protein is wheat, is about this stage. About this stage. Within a week to 10 days, because at this stage, this is called the water ripe stage. This is a little more advanced, but water ripe stage. And at this stage, the plant is not differentiating anything in there. It's just accumulating all kinds of nutrients, and it's building ameloplasts. So a plant can be
restricted in growth by having a small sink, which means it's got a small seed with few ameloplasts to store, or it can be restricted by the source not having adequate to fill the sink. Either one or a combination leads to a poorer crop. This stage is when you can put on nitrogen, and you're going to get most of that nitrogen into the seed and have it incorporated as protein. And that's the end, and look forward to the next stage. You don't have to read all this at one time. It's pretty heavy. But if you store it, go back and review it, I think you'll find, when you think about how you look at plants the next time you see them, maybe you'll have learned something. I hope so. Thanks a lot. Oops, where are you? I can't hear you.
Beautiful, oh. Mike. Thank you. Was that, felt like you were talking to an empty wall?
Well, it is. It's some.